got a lot tied up inside. Got Jesus on your mind.
Hey everybody, welcome to the fourth episode. Can you believe it? We've made it to four of This Conversation Rocks. I'm Diane.
And I'm Todd.
And welcome aboard. So, Todd, how you doing this week?
Hot. So, I hate to say it because I know everybody else in the country is in a deep freeze for the most part, but down here we are actually suffering through a heat wave. It's been in the 90s for the last several days, which is as wrong as it can be because it's March. Anyway, global warming. Who knows?
I have to say, we actually finally got a little bit of winter. It's been in the negative teens here in the morning, which I've gotten kind of wimpy. That's getting old for me. So I'm looking forward to this going away and having some summertime. I guess I live in Alaska. I should probably expect that, huh? Except it hasn't been like that most of the winter. So global warming. There you go.
Yeah.
All right. So we decided that in honor of Kirk Manley over at Biters, who has just about finished our podcast art for us, this week's topic is going to be death, because our podcast art is loosely modeled after Neil Gaiman's death from Death, the High Cost of Living and the Sandman comic books. And we got our pencil sketches this week.
And she is gorgeous.
She is gorgeous. Wow, they were awesome. So we had, what, five or six to choose from? And we finally came to the decision, and we're waiting for the final ink on the one that we chose. And then we'll be able to share her with everybody. So we're really looking forward to that.
Again, Kirk, thank you so much. They were beautiful.
Yeah.
You are brilliant.
So, and I just want to put a plug out there. I know I've said it from the beginning, but please take a look at their website, Biters. Kirk does some great tribute art for The Walking Dead. They also have a comic book called Z-Girl and the Four Tigers that is really great. So if you like Kirk's art, there's a couple of places to access it.
And when we return, strap yourselves in for this week's conversation. And this your bitter life.
Nothing just won't do. So anyway, death. We haven't even really given this one a title yet. We're kind of hoping it will pop out as things come along. There's a quote that I've always loved by Robert Heinlein, and it actually came up in a conversation with a patient this week in kind of a backward way. So if you don't mind, Todd, I thought I would share that as the opening.
Excellent.
I have this patient who I just adore, and I can't describe him in any great detail because Alaska is a pretty small community and he'd be pretty recognizable, but he's getting up there in years, and I told him this week that when he goes, it's going to just break my heart. And he kind of winked at me and cracked this big smile and said, "Well, sweetheart, none of us gets off of this rock alive," which was pretty much a summary of my favorite quote from Robert Heinlein, which is, "The supreme irony of life is that hardly any of us gets out of it alive." So, that's a pretty good way to start off talking about death.
Yes, it is. There's one quote I'd like to add to it, or paraphrase. And this is, I think, actually from Neil Gaiman, from a brief comic written on sexual education with Death and John Constantine. Basically, life is a sexually transmitted disease that is invariably fatal.
Wow. We're just going to make it grim right away, aren't we?
So, you know, the thing with death, and this is where I come to the conversation from, right? I've been fortunate. I haven't had anybody close to me pass. I do have parents who are getting up there in years. I have a stepfather, unfortunately, who is suffering from Alzheimer's. So, you know, death is becoming more real in my family than it has been before. And it's interesting because nobody wants to talk about it.
Well, and you know me, professionally, I deal with death in some small, big shape or form almost every day. So it's been a big part of my life for a long time, but you know what? You're right. I'm still in a place where nobody wants to talk about it. So that was one of the things that I really wanted to talk about tonight, was really talking about death. And talking about different aspects of death, like end-of-life planning, funeral homes, funeral arrangements, those kinds of things. Those things that, the nitty-gritty, scary, gruesome things that none of us really want to talk about, that are the things that we need to embrace if we're going to accept other people's deaths and if we're going to die gracefully ourselves. So I think we actually are both coming to the table in a fairly similar place, even though our life experience with death has been somewhat different.
Excellent.
So this is actually such an interesting topic to me, and I think we're going to have a great time talking about it, even if it's morbid.
It's not so much morbid, it's just, it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think part of it is that we can talk about this more, but part of it is that we live in this culture, unlike many cultures around the world, where we have sanitized death completely out of our everyday experience. I mean, the only time that you come even close to death, unless you are a healthcare worker or an emergency services worker, is when you go into the very quiet, peaceful, sanitary mortuary. You know, you're at the sterile graveside with its astroturf, and the grave dirt is politely hidden so no one has to think about it. You know, I mean, I'm serious. We do everything we can to make it as sterile and benign and peaceful and calm as we can.
No, I'm laughing because I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
There's a cemetery not too far from my house that's on a main street. You know, so you go by from time to time, and they're either, you know, getting ready for a burial or, you know, in the process or whatever, right? And it just, what you said, it just struck me. It's like, yeah, that's actually totally what they do. I just hadn't ever really thought about it before.
It is, because we don't want to think about that. It brings me back to an episode of 6 Feet Under. You remember that show from the 90s from HBO?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, fabulous show. And I remember one of the first episodes when, in fact, I think it was episode one, when their dad was killed in the hearse accident, and Nate Fisher, kind of the rebel son of the family, just loses it when he's watching everybody use this tiny thing that looks like a salt shaker to shake dirt into the grave, and he just starts throwing clumps of dirt into the grave, kind of freaking out, and then his mother joins him, and finally she cracks and shows some emotion, and it was a pretty cool scene. It was a pretty cool show. Definitely, Nate was a good advocate for people being in touch with the reality of death. He and his brother David were good foils for each other. So I dug up some statistics to really get us started, because like the guys are over at Biters, I think anytime we can look at some hard and fast numbers to really get us going, it's a good thing to do. So this is from some work that the Pew Research Center did in January of last year. And I'll try to make this quick so we don't get really derailed by the numbers, but here we go. On the subject of end-of-life planning, 37% of Americans report in this survey that they gave end-of-life planning a great deal of thought. 35%, so one-third, said that they had actually documented their end-of-life wishes, including medical care. 25%, so that's one-fourth of the people surveyed, said that they had not given very much thought or had given no thought to end-of-life or medical care, end-of-life medical care wishes. So a quarter of us are walking around out there with no plan.
That's me, by the way. That's me.
You? And have you articulated anything to your wife?
Oh, yeah. We've had the briefest of conversations. We're both agreed on cremation, and that's that.
What about what happens if you get in a horrible accident or experience a terrible illness and can't make decisions for yourself? Have you talked about that?
We're still working on it.
That's big stuff. So, I'm sorry, I have a hard time wrapping my mind around that, because what I have said to Nick almost since day one is, if it is inevitable, if there is no chance or only a minimal chance of me surviving something in a meaningful way with cognition intact, you put that head, or you put that pillow over my head until my feet stop kicking. I'm not kidding you. Just because I've seen so many circumstances where people have been resuscitated and there has been little or no cognitive function, I've seen circumstances where people have experienced miserable, protracted protracted deaths, that's just not the death that I want for myself. So, which leads to the next statistic. So, 66% of Americans say that there are circumstances under which doctors and nurses should allow a person to die. 31%, so we're still talking one-third of the country, say that medical professionals should do everything possible to keep a patient alive.
Well, that's horrible.
Yeah. Wait until we start talking about what that means in the last 6 months of a person's life. I thought this was really interesting. So there are differences in terms of end-of-life beliefs across racial and ethnic lines. 65% of whites say that they would stop medical treatment if they had an incurable disease and were suffering a great amount of pain. Whereas 61% of blacks and 55% of Hispanics in the same circumstances would still tell their doctors to do everything possible to save their lives. And the Pew researchers who looked at that particular question felt like it was really cultural and religious beliefs that made the difference in those choices. So I thought that was kind of interesting that there was such a big, it's essentially a flip-flop of the numbers depending on a person's culture.
So does it, is there anything specific about if you're this religion or that religion?
I didn't dig that deep. I didn't look any further into it. And this was kind of a fast fact sheet from Pew. So it didn't go any deeper in the particular site that I looked at.
Oh, not a problem.
I suspect there probably is, but I didn't go any deeper than that. So the next one, the nation is divided on physician-assisted suicide. Pretty equally divided, actually. 47% in favor, 49% opposed. Although it does seem like the person's individual circumstances influence people's decisions somewhat. So again, if someone is suffering horribly or, depending on the disease, that seems to make people a little more or a little less in favor of physician-assisted suicide. And 4 states currently permit physician-assisted suicide: Oregon, Washington, Montana, and Vermont. So we have a long way to go as far as having a conversation around that as a country.
It's interesting, because Montana wouldn't have been one that jumped to mind.
No, not for me either. Montana's not exactly a liberal bastion, but at the same time,
this is not really a liberal or conservative issue.
No. And the other thing is it's really an idea, it's more about independence and autonomy than it is about liberal versus conservative. And so I think that's really where the people of Montana are coming from.
Oh, I would agree with that.
So, and it was interesting, they said something like they had not actually recorded actual numbers since the law went into effect because they didn't make any mechanism for recording it, whereas they've recorded actual numbers of people who have used the law in their favor in Oregon and Washington since those laws went into effect. Okay, so here's what's going to really freak you out, because this freaks me out, and I see it every day. So this is from Kaiser Health News. It was a report that was prepared in 2013. So the total amount of our gross domestic product that we spend on healthcare is 18%. So that's actually double of what most industrialized nations spend on healthcare.
Which is a whole other podcast topic.
Right, which I'm sure we'll cover at some point.
Coming soon.
Medicare spending actually is 21% of U.S. healthcare spending. So what we spend on the disabled who have Medicare benefits and seniors is 21% of our healthcare spending. And that amounts to about $554 billion a year.
That kind of makes sense, though, right?
Right. And actually, you kind of think that's a fairly small number when you're talking about spending that on the disabled and the aging.
Yeah.
And I don't begrudge that percentage.
Well, because what was that total number then?
The total number in terms of dollars or in terms of percent?
In terms of dollars.
$554 billion per year. So, but here is the really disgusting part of that number when you pick it apart. 28% of that money, that $554 billion a year, is spent in the last 6 months of a person's life.
Right.
So what that basically means is that we're spending a third of that budget on keeping someone alive, not necessarily giving them quality of life, but giving them quantity of life, which is something that we'll probably talk about quite a bit tonight. So we're heaping all of this technology on people in the last 6 months of their lives, but not necessarily giving them any real benefit besides prolonging their lives.
Rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, as it were.
That's an excellent comparison. I'd like to be able to credit this person. I sure wish I could remember who said it, but I've carried this phrase around in my head for a really long time. Our technology has outstripped our ethics.
But our technology has always outstripped our ethics. This is nothing new.
No, but in terms of healthcare, we can always do something to stave off death for a few more minutes, a few more hours, a couple more days. But is it ethical? Are we doing right by that patient?
Well, that's always the question, right? But, you know, so here's, okay, from a guy who's completely outside the system, here's a few of my thoughts about why it works the way it does. First of all, unless you've got a DNR, you know, a concrete DNR, I imagine the physicians, nurses, assistants, everybody involved are going to err on the side of keeping the patient alive.
Right, unless you have a written DNR, which is a do not resuscitate order, or unless you have a designated healthcare proxy, who is a person who is legally your healthcare decision maker saying, do not resuscitate, or unless you have family members who are all in agreement, or the majority are in agreement that you are not resuscitating, we're going to resuscitate. That's just the way that it works. So, yeah, if it's not written down, and if the family's not in agreement, the status quo is to resuscitate.
That's the problem, right, is that you're trying to make that decision. People are trying to make that decision under the worst
right.
conditions imaginable. Going back to your point about having had these conversations ahead of time.
Right, that's what I really want to advocate for while we're talking tonight, is that people should be having these conversations when they are well, when they are feeling okay emotionally, and when they're not feeling a lot of pressure to make these decisions, because we need to be facing this now, when we're relatively young and relatively healthy, versus when we're in a tremendous amount of pain or under a tremendous amount of distress. It's much harder to make those decisions when you've got somebody staring you in the face saying, should we turn this machine on? Or, I'm sorry, should we leave this machine on or turn it off?
So what's your experience, or what's the overall experience? By the time you're on the respirator.
Well, you know, I'm going to kind of skip there were three things that I really wanted to talk about tonight, and the two of them kind of blend together, and then one of them is a little bit about the funeral industry itself. But I wanted to talk a little bit about quantity of life versus quality of life, and then I wanted to talk about really losing our fear of death, or how we lose our fear of planning for death. So that kind of takes me to something that I watched today that I had seen before, or I'd listened to it before. So PBS Frontline does a podcast. So for those of us who don't have reliable TV access, you can still hear their episodes. And they recently did an episode called Facing Death. And you can stream it. I actually found it online today. And one of the doctors that was being interviewed in this program said, you know, typically people find it much harder to discontinue an intervention once that intervention has been started. And I would agree. You know, once somebody has been put on a ventilator, once dialysis, which is a replacement of kidney function, has been initiated, people find it much harder to discontinue that than to make the decision not to start it in the first place.
Okay.
There was one point today while I was watching that documentary, and Nick was watching it a little bit with me, and I was getting really angry with a couple of the physicians who were featured in it, because they were talking with a family member whose brother was dying. He was truly dying. He was in liver failure. He had a horrible cancer. He had failed his bone marrow transplant. He was truly dying. And she said, I just want someone to tell me, is he dying? And they wouldn't say it. They would not, they were kind of hemming and hawing, and no one would really say it. And I thought, you know, if I were sitting there, I would say, yes. I would just come out and I would say, yes, he is. And all we are doing is prolonging his suffering. And these docs were all docs at a big hospital. You can watch Facing Death and you can find out what hospital they were at if you want. And they're pretty aggressive. They all work in the bone marrow unit. They all work in cancer treatment, and they are very committed to as much treatment as they can get to their patients until it's absolutely hopeless. And even when it's absolutely hopeless, they could not say, yes, this man was dying. And I mean, I was literally screaming at the screen, just tell her, just be honest with her. Because that's what she needed to hear in order to make good decisions for her family member.
That's truly tragic.
Sorry, I'm kind of going off the... I'm just completely going off board already.
No, it's good. It's good. I mean, because the point's worth making, right? That this is what you are likely to encounter when you get to this point. And it has everything... It has so much to do with just our culture, the culture of medicine itself, with our religious beliefs that tie it all together. And the fact that we are the most litigious society in the world, so nobody who's giving care to your loved ones wants to make a decision that's going to result in a lawsuit.
Right. Oh, isn't that the truth? Well, the other thing that was really interesting in that documentary, and I hadn't really thought about it from this perspective, but one of the docs was talking about the origin of the ICU, the intensive care unit, and she said, you know, the origin of the ICU was you came to us really, really sick with us being pretty sure that we could get you back to a place that you were functioning, get you out of the ICU, get you better, get you home. And she said now what's happening is most people are having trips to the ICU that they're coming to the ICU to die, or they're having recurrent trips to the ICU because they're chronically, critically ill. And she cited some statistics that I thought were really interesting. She said at any given time in the U.S., there are 100,000 chronically, critically ill patients, and that costs the healthcare system $25 billion annually. And she called these people the broken survivors of intensive care. And we're talking about the people who have to have a trach and be on a ventilator because they can't breathe on their own, or the people who are not mentally capable of participating in their care because they have a brain injury and they're never coming back. I mean, those kinds of situations. So I thought that was pretty powerful. The chronically, critically ill. We've lost the point of what the ICU was supposed to be. It wasn't the place where people were supposed to come and be kind of held in this state of suspended animation while we figured out whether or not we, as the survivors, could let them go. It was the place where they were supposed to come, get patched up, move on in the medical system, and get better.
And to be honest, right, I thought that's what it was still doing.
Yeah, well, and there are times, absolutely, that the ICU still serves its purpose. I mean, I'm talking about this thinking about the son of a friend who was in a terrible car accident last year. We did not think he was going to survive, and he is a miracle of the ICU. He is up and walking and talking and still healing today, but I would say there are just as many people who end up in there to die because, you know, we didn't have the conversation about what are we going to do if you have a stroke or a heart attack? What are we going to do if you have a massive head injury? So that kind of brings me to one of the next things that I wanted to talk about, which is a book that I read several years ago. And it is a book by a guy named Robert Martinson. It's still in print. I checked on Amazon today. His last name is Martensson. And the book is called A Life Worth Living. And what he really talks about, and he uses case studies to illustrate it, case studies from his practice and case studies from his own life. He actually tells the story of his father's death. And he's really talking about the idea of extending a life just for the sake of prolonging someone's time on this planet, or respecting quality of life and helping a person with a terminal illness live a meaningful quality existence before they go that may not be as long as it would be if we intervened in all of these intensive medical ways, but that was less painful. You know, they had more time to spend with their families, that was quality time, those kinds of things. And I can't speak enough about how fabulous this book is and the story that sticks in my mind. So one of the stories that really sticks in my mind from this book is it's the very first story in the book, and he talks about a neighbor of his who actually waits until she knows that he's on shift. He worked in the ER at that point in time to come and see him because she had been out of healthcare. She had not gone to see a regular healthcare provider for quite some time, had a breast concern, didn't want anybody else to know about it, and he basically diagnosed her with a very aggressive form of inflammatory breast cancer in the ER. And he got her in touch with appropriate services, surgery, oncology, all of those different specialty services she needed that day. And she ended up getting involved in clinical trials for different types of experimental medications. And it was really sad because he watched her go through this very protracted, painful death because of all of the things that she decided to do to try to prolong her life. And around the same time, one of his colleagues got diagnosed with cancer, and his colleague said, "Nope, I'm not going to do all that stuff. I know what happens when you do all of that stuff." And he actually lived longer than they expected him to, had a pretty high quality of life, was actually able to maintain some of his professional practice, which was his choice, and spend some good time with his family before he finally passed away. And the glaring differences between the two of those experiences. And who got more healthcare? Well, the lady who was doing all the clinical trials and all of that, but who had better outcomes? The guy who said, "No, I want to do as little as possible." So that has always stuck with me. And his book is filled with examples of people making similar decisions. And I can't recommend it highly enough.
Oh, that sounds great.
It was really good.
I've heard that a few times, though, that, you know, physicians and nurses often choose not to have any dramatic actions taken.
The other thing that was super interesting about that book, and I wish I had my copy of it. It was one of those that I lent out and it's never found its way home, which I hope means that it's somewhere changing somebody else's mind. is that he went through what the different levels of clinical trials mean. And so depending on what kind of clinical trial you're doing, basically, like the first stage of clinical trials of a medication, they're just finding out what is toxic. They're not even finding out if it can really help you or not. And then, like in the second stage, they're finding out, okay, what's the toxic dose of this compared to the toxic dose of a routine medication? I mean, they're not really even looking for a cure. You truly are a human guinea pig. And people don't understand that. They get all of this legal mumbo jumbo put in front of them. And what they interpret is, this is a possible cure. And they sign off on doing all of these trials and never really get good explanations about what they're doing. So if nothing else, if anybody who's listening, if you or a family member is thinking about being a part of a clinical trial, read the first couple chapters of this book just to get the information about what those stages of clinical trials actually are. It was pretty powerful, and it was stuff that going into a master's program in healthcare, I didn't know. And I had been, by the time I read this book, I had probably been a nurse for 14 or 15 years.
Yeah.
And it's $8 on Amazon. It's $8 well spent, if you have a Kindle. If you have a Kindle or a Kindle program. It's like 11 if you buy a paperback.
Okay, a brief programming note. We do apologize, but we're having some technical issues uploading a file as large as this podcast turned out to be. So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and take a break here, split this into two parts. This is the end of part one, and please pick up the beginning of part two, and we appreciate it. We're going to get this resolved so we don't have this problem in the future, but again, thanks for your patience.